For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
For the recording, the talk is on consistent practice. As we could see, though, at some point, everybody made a decision that their curiosity has abated a little bit about what exactly is necessarily going on in a practice center. And there is some kind of commitment made to incorporate this into our lives somehow. So I wanted to talk about what's generally viewed, the traditional ways that's viewed, incorporating it into your normal life, your daily life, and some of the difficulties that can arise while we try to do that. And then I was hoping it could kind of open discussion up when I'm done speaking as to how people have met some of those difficulties and maybe some of the solutions we've found for each other so that we could help support each other. Sometimes when the difficulties arise, we think they might be unique to ourselves. And I felt that if we could express some of the ways we make practice consistent and then some of the difficulties that come up, we could also see that many of us are not alone in those difficulties. But anyway, the first way, as we all know, we make practice consistent is hopefully instilling a regular Zazen practice in our lives. That alone could be a major challenge. The suggestion in the beginning is usually find a period of time, and that could mean 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Some people can find more, but most people are challenged to find at least any of those, 10, 20, or 30 minutes, and do that on a daily basis, or maybe a regular weekly basis. It could be every day. It could be every other day. It could be twice a week. It could be once a week. But either way, that usually is the first way we try to commit to some kind of consistent practice. That by itself, again, we're a lay temple, everyone has different commitments and responsibilities, can be a bit of a challenge. The nice thing about doing that, though, if we are committed to practice, is that it gives us an opportunity to engage with practice in a regular fashion and to explore what happens when we do that. Oftentimes in the beginning, we have an idealized version of what meditation practice is. The more we commit to a regular schedule, we'll often find that idealized version gets slowly dismantled, which in many ways, for all of us, it kind of needs to if we want it to be part of our daily lives, because we don't live in an idealized life, even though we might like to. I feel, since we are a lay temple, and I felt it was important to say that in doing so, in creating a daily meditation practice, the first thing we all have to look at honestly is the commitments we already have in our lives. And to realize a regular Zazen practice is not in conflict with those commitments. It should help us embrace those commitments. So we have to realistically look at what those are, and then realistically say, what can I commit to my Zazen practice? And in so saying that, it might be 10 minutes a day every other day. And that's okay if you could actually meet that schedule without it interfering with the other people in your lives, without you resenting them for pulling you away necessarily from doing it. Because it's very important that we embrace them, because it is ultimately a holistic practice that's relational. So to keep that in the proper perspective. For some of us, you know, if we live alone or whatever, we still have professional commitments. It might be a little easier to adhere to some kind of discipline schedule, but we have to realistically know what we're managing in our lives. And that'll make all of it a lot easier. When you have a consistent practice, some things that can be revealed. And again, this is from my own perspective. When we open this up to discussion, other people, I'm sure, will have other things to say. But you stop judging yourself on how good or bad your practice is, because you'll realize with consistent practice that you are a different person every moment of your life. And if you regularly sit for a regular amount of time, that usually becomes evident that the practice is different all the time, and that you could stop judging yourself about it. You get to know your own mind. You get to know what's going on in the workings of your mind, because you're not waiting for the right time to sit. You're just sitting according to the time you've committed to. And then you also learn there's a lot of impermanence within the stillness, among many other things. Some of the difficulties now, which I think we're all aware of, is if you don't adhere to your schedule, you may feel guilty and you may start beating yourself up. But what a perfect time to practice compassion first to ourselves. And by practicing compassion to ourselves, we can learn how to practice towards other beings. So even though we could have difficulty, it actually offers us a practice opportunity. Monkey mind, which is a nice metaphoric saying for when the mind jumps around. So it can be difficult to sit at the same time all the time if you don't feel your mind is somewhat placid. And monkey mind can be a real issue because it can make sitting very uncomfortable, even if it's for 10 minutes. But it's a perfect opportunity to try and practice a concentration practice that might help still the mind. In Zen practice, we always point to the breath. And me personally, I like that. I like to connect to my breath because I have an awful problem with monkey mind, always have. And that tends to help my nervous system calm down so that I can then go deeper with my zazen. For some people, it might be listening to the sounds in the room. It might be feeling tactile sensations. It might be focusing on something visually. There's many forms that could take. But oftentimes, if you connect to a concentration practice, it helps calm the nervous system. So then you can open up to just sitting. Okay? So again, another practice opportunity, not a bad thing. It might just be a practice opportunity we didn't anticipate, but it's still there. Physical or emotional discomfort is also another difficulty with that. And we could have talks just on both of those by themselves. But for brevity, to learn to relax into the discomfort and to understand that discomfort, as we know, is part of our daily lives. So there's no reason to believe it wouldn't be part of our zazen. And since discomfort is a part of our daily lives, in zazen, we get to practice how we respond to discomfort and maybe try to relax and stay settled within it, if possible. And there is a lot that can be said about that. I'm not encouraging anybody to sit through excruciating pain, whether that's emotional or physical. That's not what I'm encouraging here. So please don't think that's what I'm saying. If you are extremely uncomfortable, definitely change your posture or stop meditating if emotional things are coming up that are too difficult to handle in that moment. Oh, and then there's boredom. But I'll save that for later. I'll get other comments. But we have to acknowledge the boredom's there, just like it is in our daily lives. Okay, then if you can establish a regular schedule, usually if there is a next phase, because practice is always circular, and it takes on a life of its own for each individual, and Zen practice acknowledges that there's so many variables in each of our lives that no one could absolutely understand how you should set up your own regular practice. Okay? Our Buddhist practice, our teachings, sitting in zazen, makes us realize we're an amalgamation of many things. So these are all just suggestions, and historically speaking, these are some of the things that happened for people as they pursue practice opportunities. But generally, you start regularly attending with a group. It might be a sitting group. It might be an organized practice center or temple like Ancient Dragons Endgate. And the advantages of doing that, like anything else, is that it helps us comply with what we've committed to do. Because you kind of don't want to disappoint each other. And you know people are expecting you to be present. And even if you didn't commit to being there, if you didn't say, yeah, I'll see you next Sunday, when people start seeing you once a week, once every couple of weeks, there's an anticipation that you're going to see the same people, and for the individual coming in and for those in the room. And this helps us without, sometimes it's expressed that it does help us sit, but many times it's just implicit that we're showing up because we all have an interest in this. We all have a commitment to it. And this commitment and interest is helping keep all of us floating among the practice water. And it could be very helpful. That was the main reason I came to Ancient Dragon, is I was having a hard time setting up an individual meditation practice for myself. And I know I needed help doing that. That was the main reason I came, because I wanted instruction on how to do it. And I also wanted encouragement from other people to kind of help me comply. So that's one of the advantages. Other things that might be experienced over time is the power of meditation with a group. And I'm not going to say a lot about that because it's just something we all explore. You know, Zen encourages us to have an experience with our practice. So sitting with a group definitely has, from my own experience, from what I felt, a type of deepening power to it that I personally can't explain. But it also helps me personally, helps the nervous system calm down, knowing we're kind of creating a Buddha field with each other. And I found it helps my meditation practice deepen. And what I mean by that is I can relax more deeply into my practice without the monkey mind, without painful things coming up. Even holding my physical posture, for whatever reason, the power of the group is easier for me when I'm in the group. So that's some of the advantages to incorporating regular group sitting practice. Some of the difficulties, though, is other responsibilities might pull you away. So again, there's that guilt. You're letting people down. You're disappointed you didn't show up. But that's part of realistically realizing how you can incorporate this. That goes back to setting that regular Zazen practice. And I think expectations getting dashed is part of group practice as well. We again have an idealized version, usually, of what any kind of religious practice could be. So that we bring all that baggage in usually anyway, whether we practice any religions or not. It's in our culture in many ways. It's in our the way we live our life. We have idealized ideas on what that should look like. And then we also have an idealized version of how we should act within that group sometimes as well. And so those expectations could get dashed with irritation or dislike among the people you're with. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you absolutely can't stand people, but we're human beings and we don't necessarily feel warm and fuzzy toward each other all the time. And what I mean by irritation is you could be sitting next to someone and you don't like the way they're breathing. And they can't stop breathing, though, right? But maybe they have a cold or maybe they have allergies. Just little things like that. Sometimes that could be enough to derail coming to a group, but usually there's more to it than that. But again, it's a wonderful opportunity to practice. To look at ourselves, why am I getting so irritated because this person has a cold? What did I expect? Complete silence? You know, I'm in Chicago, I'm in a neighborhood, I'm in a room of 12 people or so. So first we look at what's happening inside ourselves as an opportunity to practice, and then we have the precepts to guide us on how to meet the people around us, whether we like them or not. with a Buddha mindset, with compassion, with right speech, with loving kindness. And we practice within a form because we know what's happening in here. So we could practice within a structure that doesn't require us to necessarily improvise a lot. So there's a safety in practicing with each other within the structure. And then when we go out into the world, maybe we'll be a little more skillful when we do have to improvise a little more, because there is really no control over what's happening out there as we move through our lives. And then lastly, trying to incorporate regular practice. If everything seems to be going okay with the regular sitting and coming and sitting with the group every now and then, we might commit to doing longer sittings, which is the full day sitting. Well, we could start with a half day sitting, which is what I did personally, because again, primarily not physically, but monkey mind, I was so afraid that I couldn't sit for half a day. But once I got into a regular routine with daily practice and coming to Ancient Dragon once a week, which I mean, really have been doing that for years, it gave me confidence that I could do half a day. I didn't go crazy, but I'm like, okay, I'm going to try half a day. Did a couple half a days. That gave me confidence that I could then do a full day. And I have to admit, I do have the idealized version of the monk at the temple. So it was important to me to be able to sit for longer periods of time, me personally, because I wanted to understand what the mystery was. And I really personally did believe that you did have to sit for longer periods of time. And I still find that a value, very much so. But everyone's different. It doesn't mean, and I do have the time and commitments that I can make that time. So then, if that all works out well, there's 3-day sittings. You could do 1 or 2 days of that, or 2.5, or whatever, which I did. I kind of negotiated all that kind of stuff for myself with encouragement from the people around me, many of whom are still in this room. And then we have Rohatsu, which for me was like breaking the piggy bank. Do you remember Ray had, there was Roy Willman, is another member, a distant member of our Sangha, who's still involved in many ways, but we don't see him online or anything like that. But I think he had a 40th birthday party where he had an event at an Argentinian restaurant in Tango, and mm-hmm. I'm just trying to show you how practice things really stay in your mind. And it was right before my first Rohatsu. And I had a lot of anxiety about doing the 5 days because, again, I knew it was going to be physically difficult. And I was pretty confident at that point that the monkey mind wouldn't be as much of an issue. So I was a little more worried about physically difficult doing the 5 days. And as we were leaving, Aishin was walking with me, and we were like, oh, we'll see you soon. Rohatsu's coming up. And I go, yeah, I'm just so nervous about it. I hope I can do it. And you said, and this is what I mean. You remember what people say to you. You go, well, of course you can do it. Why wouldn't you be able to do it? And this is something you would say, too. And then you go, plus, if you're having a hard time, we're all there to help you. Oh. And I was like, oh, my, and it literally, my heart melted. And I was like, of course. And everyone's there to help me. Now, honestly, now this goes back to variables. You know, that was such a nice, compassionate, loving thing to say. You know? And that's, I mean, it wasn't planned. It was spontaneous. But that goes to show you how people weren't that nice to me. At least I never felt they were that nice to me. To have just that support and kindness really touched me. And man, I went into that Rohatsu full metal.
Full metal, look at that fist. Yeah.
And it was
such a warrior.
Yeah, I went in there. And it was amazing. I had an amazing experience. And I do Rohatsu every year in some way, shape, or form, even during COVID. I always try to find some way to do it because it was an amazing experience. And speaking of idealized practice, it met all my idealized expectations of what practice could be. That Shaolin monk in the in the temple. I've not been disappointed by it at all. I'm not saying it'll happen for everybody, and I'm not saying I had any kind of woo-woo metaphysical necessarily experience, okay? But many things opened up. And if I wanted to be more practical about it, I could just say many things opened up in my nervous system that made me much more sensitive to the world around me and the people around me that I still enjoy very much to this day. I enjoy my life so much for it. And it's very simple, actually. It's not anything Bruce Lee crazy. Bruce Lee crazy. I did that for you. So, you know, and then there's some other things, Dharma talks discussion and all that, but I want to open it up to discussion. But I want to say one other thing. Tova Green was just here talking about how San Francisco Zen Center, main temple, city center, is really working hard, and all the major temples of our lineage is trying to make our practice more welcoming to people who come in. So she was talking about that. Was it last week? Was it last week? Time flies by.
The week before last week.
The week before last, because Tigan was talking about the dream within the dream last week. Mm-hmm. And then Tigan and her had a little bit of a discussion about how unwelcoming it was for them in the 80s when they went to the city center, when they first arrived, that it was cliquish and people weren't friendly, you know, and all this stuff. But what it reminded me of is this, so I want to tell all of you this, and I'm not... There's a tradition in Asian practices that you have to ask for teaching three times. And just even in the Buddha's time, you had to ask a question three times before you received an answer. In Asian traditions, for example, knocking on the door of the temple and asking to be admitted, the first response was them slamming the door in your face, traditionally, not even saying anything to you. Boom, door slams in the face. And the stories tell you the person sits outside the temple, no matter what the weather is, and they might knock on the door again or wait for the door to open again if someone notices they're still there. And they ask again to be admitted, and the door is slammed in their face again. And then this happens one more time. And the stories, you know, and it's in a lot of Chinese and Japanese and Korean movies, you know, there's rain, there's snow, there's wind, you're starving, you're still out there waiting to get admitted. And then finally, one of the masters opens the door and sees that you're still there and beckons you in. That's a metaphor for your commitment to practice. Now, I'm not saying what Tova and Tigan were talking about, when you take a tradition from one culture and you transplant it into another, it takes on a life of its own and it morphs into something else. So I have no doubt it became something that was cliquish and didn't feel good in America. But this is what that harkens back to in Asian cultures. It showed the sincerity of the student, but it also pointed to bodhicitta, or awakening mind, meaning your need to walk the path of practice. And I wanted to bring that up just because without difficulty, you don't really understand the love you have for practice. If you had no difficulty and it was completely easy and seamless every step of the way, you wouldn't know that you absolutely have to practice. So we could find these difficulties to be jewels in the middle of our practice. And I think I'll stop there and open it up to a little discussion and see. And again, if you're having any difficulties, you got a good team here to help you. So thank you, everyone, for listening.
Anybody have something to offer? Jerry Bodhisattva.
Thank you very
Jerry.
Much for your talk. Hi, Paula. Thank you very much for your talk. I was thinking about the last thing you said about difficulty and, you know, sitting. And when I first started to sit, sitting still, that's actually why I continued to sit. I did it once. A friend invited me to some Zen center, and I couldn't sit still. And I just was surprised by that and thought, well, I don't know, I thought there was something not right about that. But what I wanted to say is, I really appreciated the fact that when I went to sit someplace, the people there allowed me to do it badly.
Mm-hmm.
That they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't say, you know, you're not sitting still enough, or they didn't say, you know, sit up straight, or they didn't. I showed up and I wiggled around and I did my thing and probably disturbed the whole room. But they just let me continue to do it until my mind settled down and I was able to sit still. And I really appreciate that they didn't say that they did, yeah, that it was okay to just come. And how whatever level I was at was perfectly okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a real gift they gave to us.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. If the structure was too strict, or if I felt people were kind of looking down their nose at me because I couldn't sit still, I wouldn't have come back either. Yeah, I didn't find that here at all. Very encouraging environment.
I must hesitate to say this because I don't want to be perceived as correcting you.
Well, you're my teacher.
Although I do it all the time.
Yeah, you're my teacher, so that's implicit.
However, you know, you mentioned a couple times this distinction that we're a lay temple. And it's been a concern for me in America that there's this division between monastic training temples and community temples, and that you're just a lay temple, so you're not the real thing. And I know you didn't mean this.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that we're also a training temple. We're a serious training temple. People have been here for a long time practicing Zen, and we offer everything to anyone here. And so, you know, it is an interesting distinction, but I think that for Zen to thrive in America, you know, community practice is where it's at. Like you said, not everybody's going to want to go and live, you know, in a monastic center. And, you know, many of those are not flourishing these days. But I think there's something so important to value our practice together, however it manifests, you know. So I wanted to just,
thank you,
you know, elaborate on that, because there's been this tradition of saying, well, we're just a lay temple, or these are lay temples. And I don't know, you know, Suzuki Roshi, I think you have Zen Mind Beginner's Mind there, maybe?
I do.
You know, and said something like, you know, Americans, you're not quite monks and you're not quite lay people. You know, and I think we're treading this middle way together. So I just want to thank you for encouraging us so deeply, and also be careful with the lay versus, you know, what, the real thing.
So that again, too, is so moving forward with practice. And Hogetsu brings up a wonderful point for me personally, because I did want what she just stated. I wanted serious practice in that sense, serious training that relies on a commitment and relies on feedback from somebody. So we have an agreement as teacher and student that Hogetsu will give me feedback on my practice. Now, sometimes, and notice how carefully she spoke to give me that instruction so that she wouldn't hurt my feelings, let's say, or hope that I won't get offended. But I've committed to the, and I'm not, of course, but I've committed to this relationship. So Hogetsu's practicing the precepts. I'm practicing by being open-minded, like Zazen teaches us to be open, to practice active listening, to practice humility that maybe she does know better how to say these things. And I made a commitment to wear the robes, so I have to bring forth a certain archetype within our lineage, and I asked for her help in order to do that. So I should be open to that feedback. But this is, again, all part of consistent practice as you move forward down the road. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Also, I'm open to feedback, mm-hmm. which is part of the thing. Like somebody said, I said, what if I make mistakes, you know? I said, the Sangha will let you know. You know, so, you know, this is our openness, but also, you know, I know I can be heavy-handed sometimes on some of these things, so, you know, that's my thing, and I get lots of feedback on that. So, thank you, Saga. But you know, but it's an interesting thing to think about, like, our practice doesn't have to be somebody else's version, which I think you really offered so nicely.
And sometimes you will get your feelings hurt, you know? Especially like sitting longer, and like this is my experience again, sitting longer day sittings, you kind of open up, and there's like a marination, let's say, and you open up and you're open to things. And even though we're not talking to each other, as we're moving through practice, someone might say something to you that sounds, that feels or sounds biting.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be just that. And it catches you by surprise and you're hurt. But it's, if you were out in the world and someone said rah, 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 to you, then you wouldn't care. It would go off your shoulders because your defenses are up. And you have to realize, you know, as people coming together, we're still people and those things happen, but explore it. And if you are deeply hurt by something, because Ogetsu brings up an important point, you have to communicate. Don't let it fester and just sit. Talk to someone about it. Don't be afraid. This is the biggest thing I had to learn, too, in community practice. You have to talk to someone. And if it's not the head of the temple, someone you feel comfortable with. And bring it up. Don't just walk away. Bring it up. Don't be afraid to bring it up.
Ruben online has his hand up.
Hi, Ruben.
Hello, and thank you so much for your talk. It's great to see you.
It's nice to see you too.
I found myself wanting to echo what I heard Ogetsu saying about traditional monastic practice and what we do. I think my experience is that like traditional practice in a monastery has a certain set of structures that we work within. And so we have this expectation, like these are the things. You are kind of isolated and there's lots of silence. And there's these very particular ways that individuals are nourished and sustained while they're being held up. And we just have a different set, right? We still have so many structures and so many ways that we are nourished and sustained and upheld, and a framework that holds us while we fall apart. It's not different. It's just different. And so I really hesitate, just like Kugetsu said, to differentiate between them in a way that makes them feel separate or one better than the other. Yeah, I don't have a better way to say that. I also wanted to just, in case somebody else is having a similar experience that I did entering practice. Like I heard in the beginning you saying that you start with curiosity and then we come to overwhelming suffering. And my experience, or then we come to difficulties. And my experience was beginning in overwhelming suffering. Right? And diving into practice because of this overwhelming suffering. And then discovering curiosity. And of course, eventually curiosity got in the way, and lots of people helped to pop that. But you know, it can all come in any order.
Yes.
And, yeah, that's it. That's all I have.
Thank you, Ruben. And thank you for reinforcing those things. Yosen?
This is like just a teeny footnote to your talk. But I think it's worth stating, and you know, when the theme is consistent practice, clearly what you identified, regular sitting is the main one, excuse me. But, you know, another aspect of consistent practice, I know for myself, you know, I've developed just a sort of small handful of things that I avail myself to through the week. You know, I use things as reminders. You know, I hear a crow, I recite the three refuges. I mean, it's just, you know, just a handful of things that people, and I think that probably a lot of people have those things, and people I think they're very valuable. And, you know, for people who've maybe been around for not quite as long and haven't developed those things, they probably will eventually, or there are people here they could ask, you know. So thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
And then online we have David Ray and then Kirsten.
Hi, Paula. Thank you so much for your talk. I just want to chime in and say a thing or two about Sangha and welcoming. I vividly remember the first time that I came to Ancient Dragon in January 2020 and how welcoming it was. In fact, I remember, Paula, that you made tea and treats, and I remember how welcoming you and everybody else were. And I've been in and out of spiritual and religious, you know, communities all my life. And this is the first one that for me has felt like a community of people, you know, with all the positive and challenging aspects of that. And then one more story that I want to add is, my first experience of the San Francisco community. So Jerry and I spent a day or two in San Francisco, before the Green Gulch, Sangha Week. And we went, you know, we went to the building, we went to the city center, and we were walking around the corner to figure out where to go the next morning for the full moon ceremony. And then we heard a voice behind us, you know, calling to us, and it was somebody in the community, you know, just greeting us. And then they let us know what time it was going to be. And they said, you know, and this will always stick with me. They kind of smiled and said, if you want to fit in totally, wear white socks. And I didn't have any white socks, but I thought it was just delightful and so thoughtful. So, you know, stuff like that really matters. Just the welcome that people receive in our Zendo space really, really matters.
Thank you, David. And you're part of that welcoming now, too. You know, as people come in. Thank you.
Kirsten?
I think going back to what you were saying about the teacher-student relationship, what is wonderful about the Sangha in a certain way is, you know, it really does manifest when the student is ready, the teacher appears. I mean, yes, there are teachers in the Sangha always, and they teach the forms, and we can learn from them. But it also has to do with when the student is ready to take certain instruction. You know, I remember, I have to call you Sifu. I'm trying, it's kind of like, I remember.
Right.
I remember I sat Rohatsu with Sifu in 2021 during, you know, we sat doing the online San Francisco Zen Center Rohatsu together. And that was my first Rohatsu. And it was a bit of an exceptional one because it was online, but I also got to sit with Sifu. So, and then at that point, I was certainly ready to try that situation of Rohatsu because Sifu's my teacher. And now, you know, this is years later, and I have two teachers. I have Hogetsu and Sifu, you know, and but the training that is happening for me, whatever it is, and I'm just talking about, it's kind of the training to be human, right? So there aren't, I don't have to worry about, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's a progression to practice that I personally only realize after the fact or over, you know, there's a very slow discipline involved. And so I understand when a student almost has to ask for teaching of herself three times prior to asking a teacher once, you know, something like that. So thank you. I really love that you brought up that, that sense of being primed for instruction. You know, I think that does happen. And the student readies herself for it and then gets knocked down and stuff. But, you know, but that's part of the training. So.
Well, I always have fun getting knocked down along with you. Paul?
Please, you're going to.
No. Go ahead.
Excuse me. I really, this talk was great for me. Thank you. Many years ago, back in the dark ages of the 20th century, when I was first practicing, I mean, I lived at a very intense monastery, and I was doing lots of retreats, long 10 days, 3 days, 10 days, 7 day sesshin angos, and I had this very strong kind of monastic sense, even though it was not a monk, yeah. Obviously. And that's what I thought practice was, and that's still in me. I you said you have it in
yeah.
You too. And this very welcoming, family-like environment we have here is great. I mean, it's our way, right? And I'm grateful for it. But I still have this other thing. And you mentioned the old stories of sitting outside the temple, and that's not what we do. But so it's a weird question, maybe. But do you think anything has been lost? That it's not that we don't do that.
Yes. I mean, I do, because I do believe the difficulty commits us and shows us our love of practice. And then also, I think the loss of some physical discomfort as well. I'm still trying to study what that actually does for practice, but I think because we're in a state of such physical comfort all the time, something's missing. There's some impetus or effort for practice that's missing when we're too comfortable all the time. So how do you maintain that tradition and still have skillful means for our modern culture and society, which is always the koan we're trying to look at because we're not going to solve it. Aishin?
Well, that just made me think of something different, which is that I remember when I first started practicing with other people, I noticed that there were people in leadership roles and people who had jobs. And I think that's very much, you see it more in like a monastic setting because those jobs are held by the same people all
right.
the time. And as a new person, I was struggling enough, internally, but it felt like those people in those roles were taking care of things. For
mm-hmm.
me, and there is, it feels like there's somebody who's taking care of something so that I can be here. And we kind of need that,
Yeah.
We do need, in order to be able to really sit with ourselves and soften, we do need a sense that like people are taking care of things and things are going to, happen and not fall apart. And I think we really suffered during the pandemic, especially when we were coming out of the pandemic and we were trying to, sit together again, because it was just so hard and all of the things had to be recreated and all the
right.
positions had to be readapted and all of our cushions had to be put away mm-hmm. every single time. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a sense of being taken care of. And I think that is one of the things that we get from coming here and participating together is when enough people do that, we take turns, sometimes, Jerry today, Jerry's the Doan. Sometimes, I'm the Doan. Sometimes Mike is the Doan, everybody takes turns. So everybody is taken care of and being taken care of. And I think that is really, it's something that we've had to, I think, figure out how to bring that aspect to what we have so that we can, relax and soften and develop. It gives us the grounds for developing compassion for ourselves and then for others.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think
I want to say something about that too that relates to what Paul said, and that's that in order having things taken care of allows a lay community that we call ourselves or monastic community to function.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't come in and settle unless you have that kind of structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more intense and it's just focused just on zazen. That's what people are doing, let's say, 24/7 in monastic settings. And we do lose some of that, like this morning. So here's an example. our possessions sat for years being paid for in a storage unit because it was hard for people to even get the energy to go there and get them. Mm-hmm. And then they're in the garage, and also it was difficult. Paul and Neozon, I enlisted to help us start bringing in some boxes, you know. But getting just cleaning the temple, taking care of the altar, scheduling everyone, connecting, paying for things. David Ray is our treasurer. You know, it takes a lot. Mm-hmm. And to get the energy to do that, you know, in a monastic situation, once you've been sitting a bunch of retreats and done ongos, they're like a break. Mm-hmm. Because you're working and encountering all the time, mm-hmm. people in this small community, and you're exhausted by it, you know, and you're sitting zazen at the same time, so you get to sit with, you know, being annoyed at have somebody chop vegetables or something. but I just think it's so important to know that here at Ancient Dragon, you know, I could go to the garage and bring in those books, you know, stack by stack, but I wanted to wait till we start to have enough energy to do it as a group. Because if you feel like just because Hogetsu lives around the temple that she's doing mm-hmm. everything, that's not your temple anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I don't want that. And so I think this is just something really interesting, how much effort it takes to actually care about each other, and that we learn to care about each other mm-hmm. by doing these things. And this also then enriches our sitting practice. So I think it's great for that, Paul, you brought up what is missing in ancient, mm-hmm. the sense of how we care and what structure does to help support our wonderful awakened mm-hmm. hearts and minds. And I really appreciate the great effort that everyone is making, given that we're living in this world with all of its challenges. So I know other people want to say something, so sorry to go off.
Mike?
Thank you for this discussion, your talk. I have two thoughts. One is talking about community, as we've just been talking about. I remember one of the first sessions we had here in Lincoln Square after the pandemic and after the tumults, if you will, of being at Ebenezer and having to kind of tear down all the time and getting our forms back. And this is when I started as Tenzo, and I was very new to those forms and that rhythm mm-hmm. and all of that. It might have been the first time that we did a full Orioki meal here, maybe. And you know, there was some amount of nervousness with that. And I remember we came in and we had a little meeting in the Dokusan room with all the kind of leaders, you know. So I think you were there, and Ogetsu, and Nation, and David Ray, and Wade, and lots of people. And you and I probably made some silly jokes when we weren't supposed to, and
because that's what we do.
Yeah, that's what we do. But in that moment, just being in that room with a community, I felt supported, and I was like, "It's gonna be fine." And that doesn't mean it's going to be perfect or maybe not go well. But I felt supported, and I felt like we're all here for each other. That was a very profound moment for me. Of like, this is what Sangha is about. It's really beautiful. So I really am grateful for that. To go back to something you mentioned earlier in your talk about instilling like a daily practice, it took me years to figure out how to do that. And it's only been this year that I've actually started to sit 4 or 5 times a week outside of Ancient Dragon. And part of that is my partner is away at a monastery this year, and I thought, you know, if he can get up at 4 in the morning every day, why can't I get up at 8? but even thinking about the discomfort of, you know, how much, you know, maybe we've lost some kind of physical discomfort. And that was a challenge for me of always, my brain would tell me that I wanted that extra hour for sleep. I wanted mm-hmm. that extra comfort. And I said, okay, you know, it's not, you know, half of your sleep going away, you know, it's just an extra hour. And I think that little push in myself helped a lot. And when I started that routine, I found not only was I kinder to myself about days when I didn't do it, but it also helped other habits that I was instilling, like working out every day,
right.
Or, you know, and it it brought the same kind of energy, and it was really wonderful. So I was very appreciative of that. So to share that.
Thank you. Yeah, ironically, about human nature, there's something in us that will try to sabotage ourselves right when we're making positive changes in our life. And that's another thing, just to accept that's the crazy part of human nature, and you've worked around it. But you wouldn't have really examined it if that didn't happen. You know, we're running a little late.
Yes, we are, unfortunately. I think you've really opened up a wonderful discussion here, Paula and everyone here. And we actually have work period after this and tea. Maybe we'll get a few more boxes out of the garage. But I do want to mention an interesting thing that came up. And that's, Asian, you know, we were at the Cenacle. We had to put our cushions out every night. And Mary carried a samovar of hot water for tea every single meeting. And so, you know, I do feel there has been something that our culture has been beating us down, that it just to get the energy to do that. And it was just very interesting to me that, you know, for years, I mean, that was before Tygen came, you know, when Roger and I would come and set up the cushions and Sangha would be bringing them down the elevator and different things. So, so it's lucky we have a place to roost, but the Eno has some announced, or what are we going to do now? The vows, right? Oh, yeah.
Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha. Unsurpassable, we vow to realize it.